You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. I've used Grasshopper for our show's 800 number, and let me tell you, Grasshopper has never let me down. Be professional, responsive, and efficient with Grasshopper. Get your business phone number today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick.
I stopped doing stand-up in 1992.
We have a very special guest.
Get excited! Come on!
Please welcome Judd Apatow.
Thank you.
I said to my daughter, I don't know if I can do this. I'm getting really nervous. And she goes, then don't do it, Dad! Don't do it!
It's amazing I can draw a crowd, isn't it? If I'm walking down the street and somebody says, are you Judd Apatow? If I say no, they go, all right. I watch that show Hoarders, and I root for the hoarders not to throw out their stuff. I'm like, don't throw out that bird cage, you might get a bird. A lot of people smoke pot with their kids. This is what happens, you turn 18, and suddenly your parents are like, hey, we could be friends now. The truth is, I love cocaine. I'm not sure how long I want to live. I don't want to be sick. I don't want to be all messed up. If there's any doubt, pull the plug. If they say we're not sure, pull it. Just err on the side of too early. If they say I'm going to pull through, pull it.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from writer, producer, director Judd Apatow's new Netflix stand-up special, Judd Apatow: The Return. Now, if that name sounds familiar to you, it's because Judd Apatow is arguably Hollywood's reigning king of comedy. Though he hasn't performed in 25 years, he's responsible for many of the funniest movies of the past two decades. He directed Amy Schumer's hit debut film Trainwreck and wrote and directed The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, and This Is 40. Additionally, he was the screenwriter on Fun with Dick and Jane, Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, You Don't Mess with the Zohan, and Pineapple Express, to say nothing of the films on which he was an uncredited writer, which include Happy Gilmore, The Cable Guy, Liar Liar, The Wedding Singer, and Bruce Almighty. Just a few of the films he's produced are Anchorman and Anchorman 2, Talladega Nights, Superbad, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Step Brothers, Bridesmaids, Pee-wee's Big Holiday, and most recently, The Big Sick. And on the small screen, he's produced and developed the television series Freaks and Geeks, Undeclared, Girls, Love, and Crashing. And yet, for all his success behind the camera, there's still a part of Judd Apatow that longs to return to his early stand-up days when he roomed with a young Adam Sandler and opened for an up-and-coming Jim Carrey. Now Judd finally gets his wish in a new Netflix comedy special, and today he joins me on the podcast to talk about his lifelong love of comedy, from his early days interviewing comedians for his high school radio station, to his recent return to stand-up with a little help from Amy Schumer. He gives some advice to young comedy writers, his take on Hollywood's sexual harassment problem, and talks about his marriage to actress Leslie Mann. Plus, the Tao of Gary Shandling, stalking Steve Martin, and what to do when Kermit the Frog thinks you're unlovable. Coming up with the delightful and hilarious Judd Apatow in just a moment. Judd Apatow is the producer, writer, and director behind TV shows like Freaks and Geeks, Undeclared, Girls, and now Love on Netflix and Crashing for HBO, as well as basically every hit comedy movie of the past two decades, including Anchorman, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Superbad, Funny People, This Is 40, Bridesmaids, Trainwreck, and The Big Sick, just to name a few. I'd have to take a nap if I wanted to list all of his credits right now. And now he's returning to stand-up on top of all that with a new Netflix comedy special, Judd Apatow: The Return. Judd, thanks for sitting down with me.
It's good to be here.
Well, Judd, I just want to start off by asking you to address the sexual harassment claims against you right now.
Luckily, I'm clear. I'm clear so far.
By the way, for the record, Judd has zero sexual harassment claims against him. But
I also have zero sexuality.
But really, I honestly, right now, I feel like I should just open every Hollywood interview with that question and then just see what I get.
You might get someone to admit something.
Yeah,
you may trap somebody.
Well, just a few weeks ago, you wrote a very on-point op-ed about sexual harassment in Hollywood. And then in your Netflix special, you talk about the Bill Cosby scandal. As a father of two girls and the husband of a working actress, Leslie Mann, do you take that issue personally?
Well, I was saying on stage that it's funny, people get offended if you say, you know, as a father of two daughters, I'm offended, because we all should be offended. It doesn't matter if you have two daughters, you should be able to say,
right,
you know, as the owner of a bird, I'm disgusted. I think that it's an interesting time because women and men have been ignored when they've been harassed and assaulted for so long. And it's pretty remarkable that there's been this turn of events and suddenly people are getting more and more comfortable speaking up. They're getting more and more support. And now we're finding out how terrible it's been for so many people forever. So it's going to be an interesting sea change, and it's sloppy and messy and scary and something completely new, but ultimately it will be good because we do want men and in some cases women to think, I can't do this or I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. And I think in the past people haven't thought they would get in trouble.
Yeah, they thought that they could get away with it with impunity. But I suppose there's also a lot of gray area to this, and there's the potential for overkill because, sure. I mean, look, if you hadn't hit on your wife when you were both working on The Cable Guy, you wouldn't be married with two kids right now.
If you couldn't go out with people at work, we wouldn't have Ben Affleck and J-Lo.
Right.
We wouldn't have Ben Affleck and Gwyneth. We wouldn't have Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner. We would have lost out on all of that. So that is a gray area. People meet at work, and how can you be respectful? Yeah. And I think, you know, those power dynamics are something that's very rarely discussed. You know, if you're the boss and you say to a woman, do you want to go out? And she says no, I'm sure right away she thinks, is this going to ruin my career? And is he going to be weird with me? And I'm sure there are some men who won't be weird.
Yeah.
But there's probably plenty that will be. And it's all new territory. There's a lot to try to figure out.
Because you were some young green writer, and she was starring in a movie with Jim Carrey and Matthew Broderick. Have you ever confronted her and say,
Why did you prey on me? I was just a quiet little boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's an interesting thing. My wife and I, we just, you know, fell in love, and that's, you know, especially in Hollywood, a lot of people, Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, you know, they work together and they fall in love, and it happens all the time. But I certainly am aware that when that goes wrong, it's very difficult on people. It really is, because it's subtle. In an office, in a Hollywood office or any office, when you reject someone, and you could be a man rejecting a woman, there are certainly situations where you feel like, I think that's hurt me at work. Yeah. I think that's going to hurt my advancement. And so what do we think we should do about it? I mean, Mike Pence won't meet with a woman without a man in the room. And that seems insane.
Yeah.
Like, what does he think? That he can't control himself? Or the woman's going to be like, I must have you, Mike Pence. I mean, you know, we have to assume that we all can control ourselves and be respectful. We shouldn't, you know, have to, you know, be like, you know, Hasidic Jewish people, you know, having the men on one side and the women on the other side. I don't want to live in that type of reality. So these are the questions.
Yeah. Now, you talk about your wife, Leslie, in this new Netflix special. She's collaborated with you on some of your scripts for movies. Some of the best moments in some of the films, like Knocked Up and This Is 40, or some version of something that happened in your own marriage. Did she contribute to the stand-up special as well, or did you bounce ideas off of her?
Well, my wife and I, you know, are real collaborators. So when we do a movie together, we talk about it for years. Mm-hmm. You know, when you make a movie, at the end of it, everyone thinks it's true. But by the time you're shooting something, it's pretty much 90% fabricated. But you are working from ideas that interest you more than it's exactly, you know, what has happened to you. We're all trying to figure out how to be happy in long-term relationships, how to raise our kids. But usually a funny idea wins out over the truth. The truth is always way more boring than the weird thing that we might make up. She certainly doesn't help me with my stand-up comedy. She likes to come see me perform here and there. I gave the special to my wife and my two children to see what they thought before I locked it, just to be sure that they were okay with it. And all three said they would rather not watch it. So lack of interest is a key aspect to how we all get along with me doing this material.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about your two young daughters quite a bit on the special. How much shit did they give you about that?
They really don't mind at all. I said to one of my daughters, I said, would you rather I never say your name in the special? Because I cannot say your name. And she took a long pause and went, you can say my name. But what I'm really talking about is how scary it is to be a parent right now, because there's so much new stuff with Snapchat and Twitter and Instagram and everyone's addiction to technology. And now your kids are relating to the world, which is a very scary thing, and talking to strangers. And we all wonder if it's destroying them, or is this just the future? And it's like, you know, in the 50s, being mad because your kids are watching Elvis shake his hips. Like, we don't know what to do. So a lot of the material is about these fights I have with my kids and the panic I have about whether or not I'm screwing them up by not being harder on them. You know, a lot of people try to restrict the kids' time, you know, on their phones and their computers. But every time I say to my kids, you know, get off your computer, they're like, I need it for homework. I need it for research.
Yeah.
I'm like, how much research are you doing? You seem to be doing an enormous amount of research.
Yeah, you say that something along the lines of you worry whether you're going to screw them up by letting them do that, or you're going to screw them up by somehow not letting them be on their phone all the time, and then you'll hinder them technologically 20 years down the road.
We don't know. They may need to know all of this for some reason.
Well, the Netflix special is called Judd Apatow: The Return, and of course, most people know you as a director, a writer, a producer, and probably are thinking, what is he returning from?
Exactly. What am I returning from? Well, I used to do stand-up. I did it from 1985 till 1992. And then I just got a lot of writing work. And I thought, well, this must be the universe telling me to stop performing.
Yeah.
But in the back of my head, I always missed it. And then when I worked on Trainwreck with Amy Schumer, I really felt like she's having fun. I was jealous. I think I just got jealous. And so one night I said, you know, I'm going to go on tonight just to make you laugh. And I went up at the Comedy Cellar, and it actually went well, which annoyed her because I think she really wanted to see me bomb.
Really?
And then they said, hey, if you ever want to come back, we'll put you up. And no one ever used to say that to me when I first started. It was very hard to get stage time. Well, it was just difficult. You were fighting with everyone for stage time. So every night when we shot Trainwreck, I would do a set at the end of the night at the Comedy Cellar. And I just got addicted to it again. I do want to mention I'm going to be at the 92nd Street Y in New York on the 12th, just talking about the special and showing clips of weird things from my career. and I'm at the Gotham Comedy Club on the 11th, not to be a plugger, but there's nothing worse than showing okay. up and nobody's there.
Yeah. Now, you said somewhere I read that I guess Amy Schumer helped kind of get you back on the horse again and
yes.
gave you some ideas for material. And then, of yes. course, you toured on sort of a bill of comedians as Judd Apatow and Friends for a while.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a role did having this built-in comedy support network play in getting you back up there again?
Well, before I did stand-up again, I said to Amy and her sister Kim, send me premises and I'll write jokes. And so they would just like email me like, you know, questions about raising my daughters, things uh-huh. like that. You know, like what do your daughters think is annoying about you or, you know, whatever. And I wrote jokes and that's how I got started again. And then when we finished Trainwreck, we went on a tour to promote it. So the tour was me, Amy, Mike Birbiglia, Dave Attell, Colin Quinn, and Vanessa Bayer.
Wow.
And we had the best time. And I thought, yeah, this is what I missed out on. This is what I always wanted to do. But I didn't realize like that's like
yeah.
Woodstock of comedy, that tour.
Yeah, pretty much. Early on when you were doing stand-up 25 years ago, you were roommates with Adam Sandler. You were opening for Jim Carrey and you had some pretty intimidating company that you were around in those days. And maybe that had something to do with why you decided to go in a different direction, huh?
Well, it was very similar to this TV show we do, Crashing, on HBO
yeah.
when I was a young comic. And, you know, I admired people and I was very intimidated by them. I mm-hmm. lived with Sandler, who was on remote control at the time. And so he was doing better than everybody because he was on this game show on MTV. And he was the first one of everyone I knew who got Letterman.
Hmm.
And that
oh,
was
really?
A big deal.
Yeah.
He was a guy in his early 20s going to Letterman.
Huge.
And people really responded to him as someone who was going to become a megastar. So we had this little crappy apartment. Neither of us had any money. But yet everywhere he went, people looked at him like, that's the guy. And it was clear like he was going to be the guy. He had that level of creativity and charisma. And I was writing sketches for In Living Color for Jim Carrey. I couldn't get a job as a writer on the show, but Jim would pay me out of his own pocket and just come to my apartment and we would write extra sketches for him to submit. And so I was very aware that they were brilliant people out there. And as a young person who loved comedy, I kept thinking, I'm not as good as these guys.
Yeah.
And so when my writing career took over, I thought, well, maybe this is the thing that I'm supposed to do. But now that I'm older, I'm turning 50 this week, oh, I feel like I have a lot
birthday.
More to say. Yeah, it's a big
5-0.
It feels pretty good. I think I've had my breakdown already in my 40s.
Oh, yeah?
So the nervous breakdown's over. Now it's smooth sailing.
So I wonder then, you know, all of your films are so autobiographical in the sense that they kind of cover a chapter in your life. Mm-hmm. What do you think the next chapter would be?
We don't know. Maybe it's just smooth sailing and it's just
yeah.
nothing happens.
Right.
And
right.
I'm never funny again.
Yeah.
Like Judd worked
it
out.
Or it's cancer.
Or it's cancer.
Well, well, already no, you done, already did that.
I did my cancer
people,
movie.
Yeah.
I don't even have a cancer movie left.
Well, you know, it seems like almost from birth, your whole world has revolved around comedy. From the time that you were a very young kid and you were washing dishes in comedy clubs just
yeah.
so you could watch the acts on stage.
Sure.
Or
I've never met anyone
comedians.
Else who did that.
Wash dishes.
I've met so many comedians. I've never yeah. met anyone who got a job as a dishwasher
yeah.
to be near it.
I mean, you might have. There might be some comedians who wash dishes because they couldn't pay their dinner bill. Or
that's
something
true.
Like
that's
that.
True.
Yeah, and you interviewed comedians like Jerry Seinfeld and Steve mm-hmm. Allen when you were, I guess, you were working on the high school newspaper or sorry, the radio.
That's right.
Radio
yeah.
station, right? So it's really a lifelong obsession for you.
Oh, absolutely. From the time I was 10,
yeah.
it's all I ever wanted to do. In a lot of ways, I feel like. The only reason why I make things is so comedians will hang out with me. Like if I didn't make decent movies, comics wouldn't talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to get credibility so I can hang around.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Judd Apatow when we come back in just a moment. With the holidays fast approaching, we're all indulging a little more. And it can be harder to ensure that you're getting all your nutrients in. That's why there's iFit Nourish, a customized protein drink that's jam-packed with all the essential nutrients you need. iFit Nourish is unlike any other nutritional shake. It allows you to personalize your mix while delivering the highest quality of fruits, veggies, and protein, plus 25 essential vitamins and minerals. And since iFit Nourish is passionate and picky about their ingredients, there's no artificial flavors, no added colors, no preservatives, and no fillers, ever. iFit Nourish focuses on the basics of human nutrition, so every single ingredient in your formula is included for a reason and backed with extensive research. And don't worry, all of their flavors have been approved by a panel of taste judges and are completely delicious. Now, folks, no one is pickier than me, but I ordered their vanilla protein drink, and I have to tell you, they taste so good that I've actually been drinking them for dessert every night. Ready to simplify your life? Just go to ifitnourish.com/kickass for a free 14-serving bag of iFit Nourish Mix and a shaker bottle. It's hassle-free and 100% convenient. That's ifitnourish.com/kickass to create your unique mix today. And now, back to the podcast. You do still get the sense that you're still the world's biggest comedy fanboy. You know, whether it's Steve Martin or Jerry Seinfeld when you're very young, or it's, you know, helping an interesting comic like Kumail Nanjiani or Amy Schumer, you seem to have that same love of comedians, but now you're this super fan who has all this power to actually bring these people that you like to a wider audience.
Well, that's the fun for me.
That's awesome.
Is, you know, when I was a kid, I would see a comedian and I would track their career. Like I'd see Michael Keaton when he was a stand-up comedian, and I would just keep an eye out. Oh, look, he's on the Merv Griffin show. Oh, he's got a TV pilot. He's on a show with Jim Belushi, Working Stiffs. And I would just track their career until they became Batman or Birdman. And now when I see someone like that, I can call them up and say, do you have any ideas? Do you want to try to develop something? And a few times it's worked out well with Kumail and Amy and people like that. So that, you know, that's what's really fun for me, is to try to crack the code of what would make a really creative, great comedy person a movie star or a TV star.
So when you were young and you were interviewing about comedy for in high school, what would Jerry Seinfeld or Steve Allen or these guys say when this kid called him up and said, hey, can I get an interview? Ask you about your
art. People would say yes because no one was asking for interviews back then.
Oh, that's right. That was before the comedy boom.
There was no internet. Yeah. There was nothing. So if you called a comedian, it wasn't like there were 100 other people trying to get an interview. No one was trying to reach anybody.
Yeah.
So it was a little easier.
Yeah. And that's something that I have to say I completely relate to, because growing up as a young kid in, of all places, Houston, Texas, I had this obsession with old Hollywood films, Casablanca and stuff like that. So every time some old actor on their last leg came through town for a book signing or something, I would call them up and try and get an interview. And of course, Kirk Douglas or whoever would like see this kid walk in the room, and you could see the look on their face. Their smile just fade away, and they're like, "What am
I?
This
would
is
show
an
up
hour
just,
of my life."
I would show up with just a boom box, like a giant boom box.
Really,
Steve Allen looked at it like, "What is going on?" Did you ever see Bill Hicks at Houston?
No. No, I don't think
great
I ever
Bill
did.
Bill Hicks was from Houston.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yes. Kennison, Bill Hicks, a lot of great comics were from there.
Yeah, and of course, I would do the same thing as you. I would do it under the guise of writing for the high school newspaper. And of course, all these kids, none of them cared about Ginger Rogers or Mickey Rudy.
There's nothing kids like more than another kid who loves Ginger Rogers.
Yeah.
It's funny because that's how I felt when I was a kid, is that I was interested in all this stuff and no one in the school was interested.
Yeah.
Nobody. But I did have a sense that when I leave school, I will meet a lot of people who are interested and I will be able to make a living. But as of now, I'm just an idiot.
And when you were growing up with this comedy obsession, didn't you basically stalk Steve Martin for a period?
Oh, I love Steve Martin. I mean, I grew up right when that exploded. That's when I was in junior high school. And I couldn't have loved him more. Still do.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, there's a story I always tell about driving by his house when I was 13 with my grandma and asking for his autograph and him saying no because, like a normal person, he doesn't want people knocking on his door asking for autographs. And then I sent him a letter asking for an apology, and he sent me an autograph book of Cruel Shoes, and in it he wrote, "To Judd, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was speaking to the Judd Apatow." And now that I'm in the business and older, I realize how kind a gesture that was.
Yeah,
because he should have ignored my letter.
Yeah,
but he didn't.
Yeah, and that's so quintessentially early Steve Martin, that sarcasm.
Exactly. The joke was a perfect Steve Martin joke.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So brilliant. And at some point, I guess, wasn't part of your decision to leave stand-up or to not pursue acting and to go into writing, didn't it have something to do with Jim Henson basically telling you that you weren't very likable?
Well, I had a bunch of different setbacks.
Yeah.
I was doing okay. I was on the HBO Young Comedian special, and I would go on Evening at the Improv and Dennis Miller's talk show. But I auditioned to host a show with Adam for Jim Henson, some reality-based drive around the country home video show. And Jim Henson didn't give me the job, but he wanted to buy all of my ideas. And then someone from his production said the reason why they didn't want me on the show was because Jim Henson said I lacked warmth. And that hurt, because that's Kermit the Frog telling you you lack warmth. And then I thought, is that even true? Is there any chance that Jim Henson said to a casting person, yeah, call Judd Apatow, and can you tell him he's not getting the job because he lacks warmth? I don't believe it. Now that I'm older, I think it's not true. I think maybe the casting director said it.
Yeah.
I don't think Jim Henson said it.
Yeah, what purpose would that serve? Unless he thought he was doing you a favor.
Yeah. Maybe. As I always say, that's like Mr. Rogers telling you you don't deserve love.
Do you remember what your act was like back then? Like,
it was
terrible. What kind of material would you talk about?
It was terrible. One of my big bits is I adopted a child through Sally Struthers, and it was my letter to my child. And the whole idea was that I was not aware of how privileged I was. So I was like, hey, how was your Thanksgiving? Ours was great. There was so much food left over, we had to throw it all out. Hey, do you play tennis? It was terrible.
So that's pretty good.
It was okay. I had a couple of moves.
Yeah. Now, your plate is so full these days with movies and TV projects. Why now did you decide 25 years after you quit stand-up to make a return to the stage?
I just missed it. I felt like it was a dream deferred. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing stand-up, and I really enjoyed being around comedians and being a part of that tribe. Someone was telling me, you don't want to be seen as a comedian. You want to be seen as a director. You want to be on that level. And I was like, I see comedians as above directors. I get more excited to see Maria Bamford, than some highfalutin director.
Yeah.
I think they're cooler.
So, yeah, you still approach it as a fan of comedy. That's still the pinnacle for
you. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the height. As much as I'm impressed by the Winston Churchill movie, I'm much more impressed by Jeff Ross's vicious joke.
How long did it take for you to build this set and feel confident that you had a tight hour or so of material?
It was about 3 years. I got asked to do the special by Netflix at the Just for Laughs Festival in 2015. And I said, okay, I'll do it, but give me another year. And so I took a whole nother year to work on it and then shot the special at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal.
Does it feel more risky and uncomfortable than when you're sitting behind a computer just writing about these things, like your life, your marriage, fatherhood? You're actually standing up on stage and in a very naked way before a few hundred people talking about all these aspects of your life.
I think the thing is that you go on the road and you perform and you get comfortable and you know, it's, I was explaining to someone in my family, doing stand-up is like a speech that you build, and every night you add a new line and you're knitting your hour conversation. Yeah. And so slowly you realize that it's working, hopefully. For me, it's an extension of the movies. If you know me from the movies, that it's almost a monologue sequel to Knocked Up and This Is 40.
Yeah, I noticed that. Anyone who is a fan of Judd Apatow movies will not be disappointed by your stand-up set.
Well,
and also
I hope
the fact that it's longer than the average stand-up special.
Exactly. And you can see
consistent
this is
with the, your style.
And I'm talking about like what my kids are like now as opposed to This Is 40.
Yeah, and sometimes you have people who give you crap about, your film is a little longer than it ought to be. And that's kind of been a nagging thing that people bug you about.
I want to make them even longer.
Yeah, and then I love that you say something in the special about one of your daughter's friends who says your movie's too long.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, I just made a documentary about Gary Shandling, which will be on HBO in March, and it's 4 hours. It's two 2-hour parts. So I kept saying, If OJ's worth seven, Gary's worth four.
Yeah, and I did notice, just to prove that I did watch the entire special, I did notice that at the very end you dedicate it to Gary Shandling.
Yes.
He was part of your start in Hollywood, I guess. You got a job writing for him when he was hosting the Grammys, right?
That's right. Even 1991.
Before the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah, 1991, in between It's Gary Shandling Show and the Larry Sanders Show. It was the first night of the Gulf War, and I got a call. I was in Dallas performing at the Improv. And I heard that Gary needed jokes for the Grammys. And so I wrote about 100 jokes and sent them to Gary. And he basically took all the jokes and didn't use my punchlines, but used my setups. And then he wrote better punchlines. And then he took me to New York. And I got to go to the Grammys. And I mean, it was incredible. Eric Clapton's there and Tina Turner and Bono and Jack Nicholson and Bob Dylan. And I had never been to anything in my whole life. And I got to be on stage with him during the show, writing jokes as the show went on. And after the show, we were walking to the party, and we see REM. And I said to Gary, hey, Gary, you should ask him to be on your new show, The Larry Sanders Show, because you are the host. You're allowed to do that now. You just killed. And he said, hey, guys, you want to be on The Larry Sanders Show? And they just kept walking. And they didn't. Michael Stipe didn't even acknowledge that Gary said anything. And then Gary goes, or I could go fuck myself. And then he was mad at me. He's like, never ask me to ask people directly. That's what the booker is for.
Now, didn't he also give you your first directing gig?
That's right. Just one day.
On the show.
It was the last season of the show. Wow. Just walked in my office and said, you're directing the next one. And I never asked. And he wasn't asking writers to direct the show. He never had anyone do it. There certainly were people more deserving than me, but I think he was a very smart person. And he had a sense that I should be a director.
Had you ever considered that? Were you like everyone who's a writer or an actor who wants to be a director?
I was hoping to direct. And I just hadn't been able to get anyone to allow me to do it. I had asked a few times, like, hey, can I direct that? And they were always like, no, why would we let you direct that? Yeah. And so he was the first person to take the leap.
Yeah. Now, what was he like as a person? I mean, he's obviously the fact that you're doing this 4-hour documentary, he must have been a huge influence on you.
Well, he was a very kind person. Mm-hmm. I had nothing but a great time with him, for 30 years. I guess it wasn't quite 30 years, but 25 years. And he was very spiritual. Mm-hmm. He was into a lot of Buddhist ideas, and he would give me books. And I remember when the first
self-help books.
Like one book was called Turning Problems into Happiness. And the premise of it was that you shouldn't be upset when something goes wrong or when you have a problem, because it's actually an opportunity to fix something about yourself. And in dealing with the problem, you will learn something about yourself and it will be good for you. So every time a problem comes up, you should be happy that you're getting to fix something about yourself. And an idea like that, I had never heard in my entire life. I wasn't religious. My family didn't talk like that, and it really affected me deeply. It affected the way I looked at the world. And
you're able to do that?
Well, I'm not able to, but I know
people talk about it in theory, but in practice, I mean, who gets in a car accident and thinks, "Hey,
this is an opportunity for me to learn how much pain I can handle."
Yeah,
but those types of moments really changed my life, and he introduced me to a lot of ideas. He taught me a lot about writing and storytelling. He was always there for me when I made a movie. He would read the scripts and give notes and look at cuts. He was just a very giving person to me.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's this Shandling documentary or whether it's your return to stand-up or, the fact that you were a kid and you interviewed Jerry Seinfeld and then you just recently produced his latest Netflix special, it does seem like so many things seem to be coming full circle for you right now. Do you ever worry that once
there's
you complete
left.
The circle, where do you go? Or
I know, because
I have another circle in me at this point.
I wrote an episode of The Simpsons during the first season of The Simpsons. I was trying to get a job, so it was a sample. I wasn't working for them. I just wrote it as a sample of my writing, and they turned it down. But then a few years ago, I was talking about it publicly, and Al Jean, who runs The Simpsons, read about it, and he pulled it out, and he said, hey, we'll make it. And of course, that means they'll rewrite almost all of
they
it.
They punched it up.
But they did make it.
Yeah.
And it came out great. And that was a big full circle moment.
What was
for
the
me.
Plot of that episode?
The plot was that they go to some carnival or circus, and there's a hypnotist who makes Homer think that he's 10 years old. And then he I forgot what happened, some sort of problem where he runs away. He's getting in trouble. I think he's also like a criminal of some kind. And so now Homer's stuck believing he's 10. But when he's 10, he becomes best friends with Homer, with Bart, because they're both 10.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't want to be woken up. He doesn't want adult responsibility. So he tries to avoid becoming an adult again. And it's very sweet. And even though they rewrote, most of it, it really captured what I was going for. So I always say they made it what I wasn't talented enough to do. They wrote the version that I was incapable of.
Yeah, or you could say I finally got to the point in my life where someone could punch up my show enough that it would be acceptable to someone.
But then I realized that everything I had done in my entire career was a version of that Simpsons episode. Everything I've done is, about young people trying not to grow up or dealing with growing up. Yeah. So it is funny that in a way that's Knocked Up and the 40-Year-Old Virgin and everything else.
And now you've mentored so many great comedy writers over the years. You kind of have a stable of writers you work with. Some people you've collaborated with on 5-6 movies at this point. What kind of advice do you give to these young writers starting out with you?
I try to say what Gary always said to me, which is it's all about honesty and truth and digging deep, really revealing yourself, just getting to that core of human behavior. And if you do that, then the comedy comes. Mm-hmm. You can't be shallow. You have to really talk about human motivations. That's what the Larry Sanders Show, it's a host of a talk show, but really he would say the Larry Sanders Show is about people who love each other, but show business gets in the way.
Yeah.
And people's ego gets in the way. And so I always think about it in those terms.
Well, sort of along those lines then, before we go, I want to run a theory I have by you. I throw this out to almost every comic I have on the show. I have this theory that every person, not just comedians, but everyone should have to do a 5-minute set at an open mic night, because in my mind, I think it's going to be a growth experience, teach humility, self-confidence, empathy, who knows what.
Yes.
Now, some people shoot it down. Some people say, maybe there's something to that. Be honest with me. Is it a terrible idea?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. I think it's always great to think about who you are and try to express that to other people through jokes, through storytelling. So the experience of trying to write your mini set could be very rewarding, but it'll probably go really badly. But the writing will be worth it.
To put it on personal terms, what did you get out of your return to comedy?
I think I got a lot of friendships.
Yeah.
I just met a lot of people doing stand-up, and that's been the best part about it, is to just go to clubs and see a lot of people I've gotten to know, who are really funny and interesting. I think it's it's widened my world.
Yeah, well, for what it's worth, I really enjoyed it. My girlfriend really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank
we
you.
Laughed as much in that as any good stand-up special we've seen on Netflix this year. So,
I appreciate it.
One more time, it's called Judd Apatow, The Return, and it comes out on Netflix December 12th. Judd, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Judd Apatow for coming on the podcast. Judd's hilarious new stand-up special, Judd Apatow, The Return, is available on Netflix beginning Tuesday, December 16th. The second season of Judd's series Love is available now on Netflix, and Crashing with Pete Holmes returns for a second season January 18th on HBO. Follow Judd Apatow on Twitter at Judd Apatow. Today's episode was sponsored by Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace for student loan refinancing. Using Credible.com's simple platform, it takes less than 2 minutes to find out if you're overpaying on your student loans. You could save thousands by refinancing. All you have to do is visit Credible.com/kick, answer a few questions, and right away you'll get real rates, not ranges of rates, from multiple lenders. Checking your rates will not affect your credit score, so you really have nothing to lose. The average user who refinances through Credible.com saves almost $19,000 over the life of their loan. And for a limited time, my listeners will get a $200 welcome bonus when refinancing through Credible.com/kick. That's Credible.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.